This is Leader ReadyCast, a monthly podcast featuring real-world lessons, best practices, and action-oriented insights for the you're-it moments when you're called upon to lead. Leader ReadyCast is the official podcast of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative, a joint program of the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the Center for Public Leadership at the Harvard John F. Kennedy School of Government. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Hi, I'm Eric McNulty, and welcome to Leader ReadyCast. You know, my late father used to chuckle when he'd share a current affairs book or article, which he did often, along with his favorite admonition, "May you live in interesting times." Well, we live in interesting times indeed. There's so much in flux that it can take a toll psychologically and emotionally, and in some cases physically. It's just really hard to keep up these days and to figure out what's going on. But for leaders and organizations and communities, the charge is to keep themselves in the game and to keep their teams engaged and productive. And to do that, you've got to keep yourself and them hopeful and healthy, which again is difficult given how much is changing right now and how much turbulence there is in the air. Now, to help me explore how leaders can navigate this liminal space in which we find ourselves, I'm joined today by Jared Bernstein. Jared's a veteran in disaster preparedness, response, and recovery. Currently, he's policy director and counsel at Morrison Cohen and a member of the advisory board for Team Rubicon. He's also an alumnus of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative at Harvard, which is where I first got to meet him. And I've always found him to be a provocative, innovative thinker. And I'm sure that our conversation will be no exception today. Jared, welcome to Leader ReadyCast.
Thanks for having me, Eric. You know, it's funny you talked about what your father used to say. My grandfather used to say to me, "Heavy is the head that wears the crown." And I think that's, you know, pretty on point for what we're talking about here in crisis leadership, that really there's a lot that comes with being in charge or being in a position of leadership anywhere in the org chart.
No, absolutely. And I think you're right, because I mean, right now, given all the cuts that are going on, all the changes in policy that are happening at the federal level, you know, people are used to the external impacts. And now they're having to deal with the internal ones as well as the external ones. And that's a whole different set of issues to get your head around.
Totally. Totally.
So let's start with your background. Tell our listeners a bit about, you know, how you came to do this work. How did you get here?
Well, you know, as a young college student, I was into politics and I interned on a couple of campaigns. And I was actually with Michael Bloomberg on September 11th, 2001. It was the day of the primary in that mayoral election. And my brother called me from Canal Street and West Street telling me what had happened. He was on his way to work. And I yelled across the room and told people in the office what happened. I am not ashamed to admit I used a four-letter word when I did it. And I remember the next 12, 24 hours that bled into weeks feeling pretty helpless to do anything other than watch TV. And I made a promise to myself that if I was ever in a position to help people, I was going to find a way to do that. And Mike won that election and took office on January 1st, 2002. And I had an opportunity to join his administration when I graduated from college. And so I went to work as a junior spokesperson with the New York City Office of Emergency Management in July of 2002. And I was there for 5.5 amazing years, but really eventful years, where we saw unprecedented disasters of every stripe, from anthrax to ferry crashes, plane crashes, building collapses, water main breaks, periods of increased threat, a transit strike. And that work was amazing and felt like it was impactful. When President Obama won, I had an opportunity to join Secretary Napolitano's staff at the Department of Homeland Security. And I was there for 3 amazing years as a senior aide to her and working with mayors and governors across the country about the Homeland Security enterprise. And you know, when I left, I was, Bloomberg, it's very hard to sort of leave the Bloomberg world. And I was fortunate enough to be part of it. And they brought me back in 2017 after the hurricanes of 2017 down the Caribbean to run a major response and recovery effort in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And so I learned a bit on the fly about doing disaster response and recovery in a U.S. territory that was geographically quite isolated from the rest of the United States. And so learning a lot about that and what the challenges were there, both logistically, but also navigating the issues of real trust deficit between mainlanders and people who live in one of the only places in the United States where you don't get a vote for president.
Yeah, definitely a challenging environment. What a great array of experience you've had being able to be right there in so many significant events. And I appreciate you sharing what you've learned through that with us, because there's a lot of wisdom I know you've developed over the years. Now, I know you're a big fan of Commander's Intent. I am as well. And I think it gives people some solid ground under their feet, yet it also gives them the agency to act. But tell me how you see Commander's Intent and how you found it useful.
For me, it's always about what is the top line thing we are all trying to get to. I think it's really easy when we're managing an emergency or a disaster or a crisis, or even now, with my work at a law firm, that it's really easy to go down rabbit holes. And I think it's really important to keep a North Star out there, to keep coming back to what are we here to do? What is our client here to do? What is the operation we're trying to get done? And at the beginning of every operational period, depending upon how you define operational periods, and it really doesn't matter what that looks like. It's just a question of, are we moving towards what we're trying to get done at the top line? And if we're not, then we need to really question why we're doing it, because it's really easy to get bogged down in details that at the end of the day don't make things better. I'm often fond of saying to both my team here and my teams that I've worked with in the past, at the beginning of every day, working day, are we winning or are we losing? And if we're losing, then we need to figure out a way to be winning. If we're winning, then we need to keep doing what we're doing and not to try and overcomplicate things. I would tell you that I believe that most things are not that complicated, that very few things actually are rocket science unless you work at NASA. And so I like the commander's intent and what that means, because it allows us to stay focused on the thing we're trying to do without getting bogged down in unnecessarily side quests.
Yeah, I think it's so true. I think you always have to remind people of what success looks like, because if you assume they know what you're going for, they will, even with good intentions, will wind up going in different places. So I think you're right. I mean, keep that focus, keep it simple, and keep them knowing where that what that larger goal is so important, because you're right. The operational details every day will bog you down and take you in different directions. You need a place to come home to make sure, as you say, you're either are we winning or are we losing. So, one of the big challenges of leading through disruption, and you mentioned after 9/11 that what hours turned into days, turned into weeks, leading through disruption is keeping your team stronger longer. I've advocated for a mid-action review as a useful way to acknowledge accomplishments, clarify challenges and priorities, and do some course correction if necessary. So don't wait for the after-action review. Do something partway through. You've also talked about in previous conversations a strategic pause. Tell us about that and why you found it so useful.
Yeah, one of the operations in my crisis management career that I learned the most on was the Deepwater Horizon oil spill of 2010. And I learned lots of things on that operation. But in this vein, one of the big failings I felt like for my office and the part of the it all that I was involved with was that we expected erroneously the oil spill to end and the issue to be resolved the next day, every day for 90 days. And what we ended up doing is burning through a lot of really good people and really not taking folks off the line, so to speak, to do that 30, 60, 90 day longer midterm, longer term planning. And it's really hard when you're in charge or when you're a key part of an operation to have the discipline to say, you, Eric, one of our key players, our key operators, you're not working on the thing in front of us anymore. You're going to go off to the side here and you're going to help plan for the midterm or the long term. That's really tough, because when something's gone bad, you want your best people in the fight. And I think that that is, it takes a lot of discipline to take some of your really good people out of an operational environment and put them aside for medium-term planning. I mean, the ICS structure does some of that for us, but sometimes, people, and I say this as a volunteer firefighter, nobody becomes a volunteer firefighter to be a logistician, right?
Right.
Nobody becomes a volunteer firefighter to become a planner. They become a volunteer firefighter to put out the fire. And that's great. And we should use our talents. And certainly you got to, get the situation somewhat under control. But you also need really smart people to take a step back and, look at the whole field and think about what you're going to need, in the short, medium, and long term for a successful conclusion of the operation. Especially because the bigger the disaster you're dealing with, the harder it is to get a true picture. I would take a point of personal privilege. One of the emergency managers who taught me the most in my career was a guy who we just lost a year ago to 9/11 cancer named Calvin Drayton, who was the first deputy commissioner of New York City OEM. And Calvin always used to tell me as a young emergency manager, Jared, in an emergency, everything in the first 15 minutes is wrong. And the bigger the disaster, the longer that 15 minutes lasts, the proverbial 15 minutes. And so I think finding those, people who you could take off the line and you can get involved in, figuring out the medium and long-term planning is really important.
It's so true, and I recall being down with Deepwater Horizon myself, and seeing how long it was. And again, people who are used to disasters that are going to last 24, 48, 72 hours in the intense phase, all of a sudden be going for months, that you can't stay on the front lines of the fight that long. You'll just no one can carry it on. So, I like this idea of normalizing the rotation through. So it isn't like, oh, it's a penalty because you're coming off the front line. It's no, this is what we do. You're on there for a while, you're back, as you say, planning, looking at long term, and you may come back again to the front line. But that rotation, when it becomes a norm, becomes the expectation, as opposed to, oh, I must have screwed something up, or gee, look like I'm falling short. No, it's actually, this is how we make sure you're there for the long haul.
Absolutely.
So there is an expectation today, particularly among younger workers, to be included in policy setting and decision making, and sort of they want to be part of making those big decisions. How do you balance inclusiveness and bringing those voices in with the more directive nature of chain of command? They both have benefits, they both have appropriate times. And so how do you find that balance to do that? This relates somewhat to our concept of swarm leadership, which I'll talk about after I get your initial thoughts. But so how do you balance those two?
Yeah, it's a great question. And if you figure it out, let me know. No, I'm just kidding. I would say, it's something we talk a lot about in my volunteer firehouse, to be honest, because you want to have, particularly in a volunteer context, right? You want to have people have enough agency to feel included. And so definitely solicit feedback, solicit new ideas, not make your organization such a slave to the org chart that if somebody who is junior comes up with a good idea that they feel like it's not going to get heard or not going to break through. But at the end of the day, we still have to have a chain of command. One of the things I really loved about working for Mike Bloomberg earlier in my career is that they were totally rank agnostic when it came to ideas and innovation. So if you were an intern and you had a good idea and you pitched it, you could get resources behind what you were doing. And even if it failed, that's okay. So I think creating a culture where we both respect chain of command, but also make it clear to people up and down the org chart that they have agency to contribute. And that they're not going to have to go through 15 layers of red tape just to, have themselves heard. I think being able to do both of that, and it's on us as leaders, right? And that comes back to, commander's intent, right? Which is we want a commander going to have an intent for both the operation, but also for how the culture that they want to run. And if they say this is going to be a culture where we are inclusive and we value what people are doing here, and that, I think the commanders and managers get the, get to, commanders and managers get to lead like that, and they get to set that tone.
You're right, and I think to me it's a matter of making that chain of command make sense, so people know when you're using it, why you're using it, and why it's important, and what the discipline it brings. And sometimes it's bad things can happen when you go outside the chain, and at the same time being open enough, as you said, to You want to surface as many good ideas as possible. And if you've, as the commander, you get to set the intent. And if somebody else has got a great idea about how to get there, you probably ought to be open to hearing it. And so I think it's a bit of moving beyond binary thinking of like one or the other to a yes and approach to, when people see the chain of command working, that's actually can be a really good thing. I know the swarm leadership, the research we did that came out of the Boston Marathon, we found these two sort of complementary behavioral characteristics going on. One was there was that people owned their lane. So Boston police, state police, et cetera, their chains of command were in place and working really well. And that, again, gave people great confidence that they knew how to do the job that they were supposed to do. And there was this generosity of spirit and action, where people reaching across saying, "Hey, do you need a hand? Can I help out here?" And they were able to then stretch across, and it didn't feel like you were stepping on somebody's territory or trying to do their job for them. It was, no, we respect the chain of command that is working, and we know there's a whole lot going on here, and maybe we can work together on some stuff. And so it became a, being able to hold those two things as both true at the same time, I think, is a real hallmark of being able to lead through a complex incident. Now, one of the things that's unfortunate we're seeing is every day in the news these days is that we're seeing reductions in headcount in many organizations. And I believe people are really tired of being asked to do more with less. I'd like to actually banish that phrase from the lexicon if we could. How about we do, what we can with what we've got? How are you seeing the thinning workforce affecting overall readiness and wellness of that workforce as well?
We, I think, are, as Calvin would say, we're in the first 15 minutes of this, right? So I don't think we know yet. I think it's too early to quantifiably say how bad it's getting. But we know that there is, only so much that can be cut without affecting readiness and without affecting core functions. I think, this isn't a political podcast, but, disruption is great, destruction is not. Is there something to be said for a wholesale rethinking of how we do, emergency management and how we do, how we do grants and programs? And is there too much? Sure. But the tearing it all down to the bone is not tenable, and I think we haven't really seen it yet because we're only a few months into this. But certainly, it will have downstream effects and take a long time to rebuild if and when people decide to change course, because you don't build institutions and capabilities like this overnight. It's just not how it works.
Yeah, it's interesting. I heard someone doing an analysis of this the other day, which I thought was really interesting. And the person said, and I've forgotten exactly where, and if I remember where, I'll put it in the show notes later. But was saying with this notion of sort of cut, cut, cut is a very, very, it's what they do in the software business. When you're engineering code, you sort of cut, cut, cut till it breaks, and then you add things back in to get it to work again. It's how you keep things lean and moving. But you can do that because in the software world, you have very fast feedback loops. People are using it, and so if it breaks, you find it right away. And what I don't think we're seeing here, we don't have those fast feedback loops. We won't know until we get the next big hurricane, the next earthquake, the next, giant wildfire, what we've got to work with.
And Eric, and what about the recovery, right? The recovery dollars, that's even going to take longer to figure out because, eventually we will get the fire out. Eventually we will rescue the people. But what happens when it takes 15 years to rebuild a school that was destroyed in a hurricane or a wildfire because there's no apparatus to do that? And because we've gotten rid of that whole apparatus and all of that human capital that, people who've spent their whole careers figuring out how to do this. So, like, I think it's gonna, it's really, we're setting ourselves up for a really bad situation.
Yeah, I think you're so right, and I think one of the things that we're soon going to unfortunately find out, or people are going to realize, is how important and how long and how difficult recovery actually is. We all know about response. We all see it. It gets on the news. The recovery work gets no glory, And it is really hard. It's bottom up, and it just takes a long time. And so, again, if you've not, people who aren't in this world who haven't done that work, I don't think realize quite how hard it is. And so, to say you're going to take that away or just hand it off to somebody else, I don't think people have a clear picture of what that actually means. And again, that's not a partisan statement. I just think it's a professional expertise statement of knowing what you're doing before you pull that trigger.
100%, 100%, and so I think we need to buckle up, and then we're going to need to figure out how to rebuild things on the fly. And other parts of society, like state governments and city governments, are going to have to figure out how to fill those gaps, and certainly philanthropy as well. I mean, it's scary.
Yeah, no, it is. But I'm always an optimist, and so I'm hoping that this is an opportunity. As you say, there were plenty of reasons to reform what was going on. There are plenty of ways to make it better, and that hopefully this will ultimately be a way if we learn from it and we are and proceed with hopefully a lot of hypotheses, more hypotheses than assumptions. As someone smarter than me once said, that we will learn and we will get to a better place. But as I say, it's going to be a very bumpy road, I think, to get there.
I was once told by one of the finest public servants I ever worked with, Dennis McDonough, who served as White House Chief of Staff and Deputy National Security Advisor and then VA Secretary. And when Dennis was in the White House and something was going bad, Dennis would look at us and say, "Never waste a crisis."
Yeah.
So, and we need to, as thinkers in this business and in this discipline, need to think about, okay, we're going to have an opportunity to rethink this. Maybe even from a near blank slate, how would we build it if we were building it over again? And so I think that that's worth giving some thought to and putting some brain power behind.
No, I think you're right. And I just actually just wrote a piece on LinkedIn just the other day. In my weekly newsletter, Leading Together, so asking the question of what would the system look like if it was built from the bottom up? Like if the communities we serve could build this, what would it look like? And I, not that I can't answer that because I'm not, the community's got a lot of voices in it, but I think it'd be very different than just building it top down. And you can surface a lot of really good ideas and a lot of great insight. So hopefully, we take this as an opportunity to get smarter and not just get leaner.
Absolutely.
So, with all of that, and we've talked about, I want to give you the final question I give for all of my guests, which is, what gives you hope?
Great question. Well, first of all, on a very personal level, I have a 14-year-old and a 10-year-old, and they are very aware of what's going on in the world and very motivated to do great things. So I think that we have youth who are really engaged in the world in a way that maybe they haven't been in a generation or two. I think that's the first thing as a sort of macro. But I would say, what we were just talking about is that there will be a day after, and there will be an opportunity for people who believe in government as, the most honorable form of public service that there is. And there will be time and a place to build back better, and to think about how we manage disasters, how we prepare for disasters, how we mitigate disasters, how we manage risk. And maybe we get to do it with, maybe not without some of the entrenched interests, but certainly everybody has been sort of put on their heels. So there is an opportunity to look at things maybe with a set of fresh eyes. I don't think it's not the scenario that I would have dreamed up, and certainly there's going to be a lot of downside to this. And people are going to suffer, and communities are going to suffer, and it is not a good outcome. But I think what gives me hope is that, if people in this space can see this crisis as one not to be wasted, and you already see it happening. The thinkers in this world are writing about it, they're talking about it, and so we will come out of the other side with new thinking or more refined thinking. And what the institutions like the MPLI are doing is continuing it to provide space for these communities to exist. And I think it's really important work. And so I would just say I'm really happy to be a part of that community. Happy to be a part of, I think I was in cohort number 3, which makes me really old. But to be part of that larger community, and now that there's so many, other options for people to partake of the MPLI, I think that those institutions really being empowered to foster innovative thinking is, I guess, a silver lining for this, really, really tough situation we find ourselves in.
But those are great thoughts, and I think that perhaps we gotta end with the note that our commander's intent ought to be to build a system that attracts your 10 and 14 year old to want to come and serve, that it is attractive to people like them who are invested in the future and who are the future coming up and will be the next generation of leaders. So if we can do that, I'm sure we'll figure out all the other issues along the way.
Amazing. Well, listen, Eric, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. This was great.
My pleasure. Great conversation. Thank you. My guest for this episode has been Jared Bernstein, Policy Director and Counsel at Morris and Cohen. He's a member of the advisory board at Team Rubicon. So until next time, be ready for your Eureka moment when you're called to lead.
This has been another episode of Leader ReadyCast from the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative. Subscribe to Leader ReadyCast wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and find out more about us at npli.sph.harvard.edu. Follow us on Twitter at @HarvardNPLI. Thanks for listening, and be ready to lead.